Right now, we're going to turn to the smile. The Iowa caucuses are over. In its aftermath, there were winners and losers, but whether it was Gephardt conceding last night, Kerry winning, or Dean hiding his disappointment at coming in third, they all came out smiling. In today's politics, politicians and smiles go hand in hand. It wasn't always like that. Presidents in the 19th century were rather grave. In fact, smiling was once regarded as unseemly behavior. So how did the smile become such a uniformly positive thing? That's the question we're going to try to answer in this segment. If you'd like to join us, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN@npr.org. If you have questions about the act of smiling, or if there's a smile in our collective consciousness that you will never forget, a painting, pop culture, or John Kennedy, Jerry Colonna, who knows? 800-989-8255. Here to talk with us about the evolution of the smile is Angus Trimble. He's author of A Brief History of the Smile, and he's with us from the Yale University studio in New Haven, Connecticut. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Pleasure to be with you, Neil.
Today, a politician without a smile might as well actually go out there with no clothes.
That's right. It is a default position, and the electronic media have made that happen. Without the close up, the photo opportunity, I doubt whether this would be so.
Yet there was a time, as we mentioned, that there was we wanted our politicians to look serious and grave.
Well, that's right. Up to a point in the 19th century, the facial calisthenics of politicians were largely irrelevant and certainly invisible. Most eligible voters depended on written accounts of speeches for information and for interaction with the electors. Even public meetings would be very difficult for more than a few people to really see the motions of the speaker's face as it is today.
Now, we can hardly know the origin of the smile. It seems like such a fundamental human expression. It certainly predates anything that we would keep records on. But what do anthropologists speculate about? What do they think about when they talk about the origins of the smile?
Well, behavioral scientists tell us that smiling originates as a vestigial kind of combat position, that it is in a sense a kind of grimace that we offer each other, not necessarily as a gesture of friendliness or open goodwill. Of course, the smile is a reflex with which every human body is equipped from birth. Mm-hmm. At around the day 41, the baby, it seems, shifts in its ability to sort of to exploit and deploy the smile in a deliberate way. And from then on, we build the smile with our personality.
Deploy is the exact word. Anybody who's ever had a baby knows they use it like a weapon, don't they?
That's absolutely true. And of course, the huge literature of infant development is of course particularly engaged with what will make a tiny baby, what will produce the response, a smiling response, and how babies will in fact use their smile to engage a parent or indeed later on a stranger.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join our conversation with Angus Trumbull, is 800-989-8255. And Justin joins us from Tallahassee, Florida.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I was wondering, you know, when you look back in photographs up to a certain point, no one seems to be smiling. And then after a certain point, particularly in American photographs, that's become sort of the de facto what you do in a picture. And I was wondering, first, approximately when that change occurred, and second, if there were any kind of cultural trendsetters that paved the way.
I'd suggest it was the moment photographers learned the expression, say cheese.
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly true that early photography was hampered by a tremendous problem, the length of time it took to capture an exposure. And sometimes that would be, in the early days, in the 40s and 50s, 1840s and 50s, up to 45 minutes. And portrait photographs remained very difficult to capture in very quick exposures before the late 60s and 70s. And it was when shutter speeds accelerated, emulsions, which greater sensitivity made possible quicker exposures, that an ever-widening sort of panorama of hitherto hidden subjects, people walking and talking, not necessarily captured in a photograph against their will, but these kinds of subjects started to populate photographic images. And as that development occurred, of course, the ability of people to react spontaneously to the camera became enormously accentuated. And of course, then everything was changed by the invention of motion pictures.
Interesting question, Justin.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Now, as you go through this, you're a curator in art museums, and of course, one of the things you look at a lot is the famous paintings that have smiles and different kinds of smiles. And I was interested in your response to a couple of famous paintings by Franz Hals. The first, of course, we know as The Laughing Cavalier. And as soon as you think about it, of course, you have an image of the painting in your book. But of course, he's not laughing.
Yes, it's an extraordinary thing, Neil, that here is this one of the great icons of Western painting, which is famous to many, many people as by its title, The Laughing Cavalier. And yet the subject of that painting is, to me, emphatically not laughing. He has a very faint, wry smile of perhaps superiority, perhaps urbane wit. But he certainly doesn't appear to be laughing. And in fact, upon investigation, it turned out that this title stuck to the painting rather late in the 19th century, that in fact before The Laughing Cavalier was simply known as a portrait of a man or of an officer. And it's an interesting signal that qualities associated with faint smiling and laughter were completely different in the 19th century from our own time. That much is obvious, I guess. But paintings like that were presented to a picture-hungry audience in England, in particular, who knew exactly how amusing and jolly 17th century Holland was, because they saw hundreds and hundreds of paintings of rollicking belly laughs, tavern scenes, musicians, drinkers, and so on. And yet they found it possible to attach this peculiar title to the picture. I think the title stuck simply because it's a good title, and good titles tend to stick to things.
Another Franz Hals painting, this one from 1625, you point to, is called The Lute Player. He's one of these rollicking denizens of pubs in Holland that the English became familiar with. This a rather more expansive grin.
It is one of the most flamboyant and engaging images that emerges, I think, from 17th century Dutch art, a great treasure in the Louvre. The side glance with a sweaty brow of a musician in the midst of playing a tune, presumably looking sideways to meet the gaze of an unseen fellow musician who's not visible, and one sees in this picture what one sees when one sees live musicians today, the same kinds of relationships, the same kinds of amusing moments that arising from the music is, it seems to me, tied up in that picture as well. I mean, these images are actually quite rare in the sense that when I started this project, it seemed to me that there were rather few images of smiling faces in the history of art. And, of course, in the time-honoured manner, upon further investigation, I found them all over the place. But even so, they are still relatively rare. And where they occur, I think, is particularly noteworthy and of particular interest.
Our guest is Angus Trumbull. He's the author of A Brief History of the Smile. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get our next caller. Charlie's with us from Memphis, Tennessee.
Yes, good afternoon. I've spent a number of years in the Peace Corps over in Southeast Asia, and I noticed among a lot of those cultures there that in any type of a portrait or a photo, even a family gathering, when it was time to say, okay, say cheese, they would be stone-faced almost invariably. It's very uncommon for them to actually attempt to smile. I was wondering if there's a cultural divide here, or if it's just exposure to technology, or what you might have found in that realm.
Angus Trumbull?
Charlie, that's a very interesting... It's a good point, because there are, in fact, indeed, cultures which have traditionally been suspicious of photography. Certain Melanesian peoples, African, Aboriginal, Australian, and other tribal peoples. The habit of saying cheese, incidentally, it was an invention of British public schoolboys in about the 1920s. The boys of Oundle School seem to have invented that habit. But I found that there were equivalents in other languages, words that when the photographer asked the person having their photograph taken to say that word, their face would assume the natural shape of a smile. And all of them, or at least most of them, turned out to be foodstuffs.
Like
as
cheese,
well.
Yeah, interesting.
Like cheese. So other languages take the English word cheese. But you're right, there are certain instances where people tend not to smile for photographs, or regard having their photograph taken as a kind of theft, and having to do with the interference in their spirit or the anima. And of course in Burma, photography is usually forbidden, and therefore the question rarely arises.
Charlie, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's get one more caller in. This is Bruce, and Bruce is with us from Summers Point, New Jersey.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I was wondering if in your research, did you come upon any correlation between the evolution in modern dentistry and the smile in the photograph? As I know it, people had pretty rotten teeth and didn't want to show them before dentistry became such a widespread profession. Did you come across any correlations?
Bruce, yes, I did. I would say that's one of the key themes of my book is the joint influence of photography and dental science in the evolution of the modern smile as a symbol of health and happiness. Obviously, you're absolutely right. People tended to have bad teeth. The standard of dental hygiene rose very sharply during the course of the 19th century. And with the improvement in the state of people's teeth, it became much easier for people to be caught or to exploit them as positive attributes. I mean, in the 19th century in England, it was still thought to be inappropriate and, in fact, worse, possibly unseemly or even lewd, to smile with your mouth open. This was something that was frowned on, bad manners. and Queen Victoria herself, it was thought, had small teeth, and although they were visible when she smiled, they were small and white, and therefore that was okay. But the implication being that would have been better if she hadn't shown her teeth when she smiled.
Interesting correlation.
Thanks for the call, Bruce.
You're welcome.
And Angus Trumbull, thank you for your time today. Very interesting conversation.
Thank you very much for having me, Neil.
Angus Trumbull is author of A Brief History of the Smile, in which, in part, he describes the smiles on many of the famous paintings you remember. Well, of course, there's one painting that all of us associate with an enigmatic smile. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.